Crystal Fisher has been extra AF for a real long time. Before we started being all cute and calling things extra, the other term was annoying. She has a long history of being completely fabulous and also painfully awkward with people. Life eating is about consuming experiences with little to no care about the consequences. She's a life eater. She's also an okay writer and loves all things that are nostalgic. She uses slap bracelets and click pins to work her way through years of embarrassing tales. She then speaks those memories aloud into a microphone in a crazy, never-ending, run-on sentence. In the end, we all get a laugh and start to think about our own experiences and the things that we used to know and love. Crystal Fisher is a storyteller. You can find Crystal and her stories wherever you listen to your podcast, as well as all the social media sites. Just search for Eat Life Podcast, where we consume experiences, forget the consequences, and eat life.
People of podcast land, are you looking for a fresh experience? Are you all WTF'd out? Tired of cereal for breakfast? Then we are the podcast for you. My name is Richard, and with my co-host Robert, we are the BazaarCast. That's BazaarCast. Your delicious buffet of talk and intriguing interviews from writers, directors, and actors to composers and other podcasters too. And when it's just the two of us guys, two continents apart, yapping away is a surefire recipe for demented, funny, crazy, interesting discussions, sure to entertain. Serious to ridiculous, creepy to compelling, that's us. The BazaarCast. You can find us on Podbean, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and other podcast catchers. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast, truly one of the most unusual ever recorded, contains dribble, slang, and frank discussion of subject matter which under no circumstances should be heard by small children, persons with a heart condition, or anyone who is upset easily. If you are such a person, or if you're the parent of a very small child in the room, we urge you to switch off your streaming device now.
Hi, Jen.
Hey, Kim, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm doing really well. What's going on?
Oh, you know, not much. We had pretty good weather this weekend.
We did. It's been fantastic.
Old people talk about gas prices and weather, and that's me these days.
And your knees. Your knees.
No, my back.
Oh, your back. Your back hurts. Yeah, yeah. So this weekend, I was interviewed by the famous Glenn.
Not Glenn.
Glenn of Glenn Think Stuff. Yes, and I was on the episode. So if you want to go listen to it now, you can hear me stutter.
You did not.
And
you
stammer.
It was nice.
He must have edited it then.
He doesn't edit. I know. God love him. Nope.
And lose my... Yeah, he like brought... The last question was extremely heavy and came out of left field. I was kind of shocked a little bit about
good.
That.
Get you thinking.
Well, yeah, on the dot. Or on the spot, I should say. Not on the dot.
But, like that, though. You've thought about stuff like that, right?
Well, yeah, I thought about it. Yeah. But it was just not what I was expecting from Glenn Think Stuff. Well, but it was still fun, and he's such a good guy. Never met him in my entire life, in real life, but he's a good man, good heart.
Good man's hard to find.
We also went to the Global Market down in Kirkwood and bought some snacks from different countries and some fruit from different countries. We tried the dragon fruit.
Is it good?
It was earthy. It wasn't as sweet as it should be. I've had it before. But I did learn that if you get the dragon fruit and it's white, it's basically a fruit from a cactus, but if it's white on the inside, it's from Asia. But if it's magenta on the inside, it's from Mexico, and ours was magenta. I also met this really nice Vietnamese woman who told me all about her pho recipes. And I think she called me fat, too, but I'm not really quite sure. It could be. I don't know.
Maybe.
But she was really sweet.
Oh,
but,
I love people.
You know, I do. But I do have something different for you today. One of our listeners, her name is Chris Maltby.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, Chris. She sent us a case for us to read today.
So she wrote a script.
She wrote a script for us.
So we have a script writer?
A script writer.
Wow.
Yeah. Isn't that nice?
Soon be a screenwriter when we become famous.
Yeah. So normally I would paraphrase my writing, but I'm going to try to read what Chris wrote. This story is actually pretty special to her. This was a friend of hers.
And it occurred pretty close to us, is that right?
Yes, in Sullivan, Illinois, which is by Decatur.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so this is interesting. And like, if anybody wants to be like Chris and send us scripts, we can't really pay you, but we can maybe work out a merch thing for you.
Merch.
Send you a t-shirt.
All right, well,
All right, you want to try it?
Yep.
Now remember, this is in Chris's voice.
I've never met Chris, so I'm just going to have to pretend.
Oh, I've never met her either, but
I talk to her
online all the time. She's a sweetheart. I like her a lot. As I write this piece for our True Crime podcast, I'm reminded of a beautiful friendship I shared with Sherry back in the late 80s and early 90s. I grew up in a small town not far away from Sullivan, Illinois. My aunt and cousin lived in Sullivan, and as I came back to live in Illinois for a few years, I had the humble pleasure of spending some time hanging out with Sherry and a few other friends. Summer nights, friends cruising down the country back roads of a small, sleepy farming community of Sullivan, Illinois. Guns N' Roses blaring in the radio.
I want to break out to song, but I'm not going to do that.
As four friends rode through the night in a blue Mustang, singing and laughing the summer nights away. Lightning bugs filled the night sky and friends bonded over music. A few drinks and silly banters back and forth as they hit the gravel roads together. The nights were young and there was joy in the air. That was years ago, oh so young and full of life. Who would have known that this funny, loving, charismatic mother of two, her life would end in such a tragedy on March 4th, 2015?
Oh, this is really recent.
This is the sad, tragic case of Sherry Stanifer Randall, a story of domestic violence and the brutal fury that was lashed out onto Sherry's body by her ex-boyfriend, Michael Yost. As the years passed and life was going on, in a moment's time, Sherry's life was brutally taken away from her. And as her friends and family found out about her death, so many were in shock at the heinous details of the crime. It is with hope of bringing the case some notice that some very important lessons are learned. Domestic abuse, violence in relationship, and murder can happen to anyone. It's not isolated into sections of the country or specific races or genders. It doesn't pick and choose who it'll affect, and the truth is all around us. There are always signs of abuse. The victim is usually scared to tell anyone, and when they do break away from their abuser, there's still pieces of control and manipulation that exists.
You know, I've had police officers tell me that that's the most dangerous call to go on.
Oh, yeah. And the sad part is once the police get there and they want to press charges, the abusee is too afraid to do anything about it.
Yeah.
It's awful. Sullivan is a city in Moultrie County, Illinois. It's a small town around 4,500 residents. It's a county seat and the largest of Moultrie County. 2 years after Sullivan was founded in 1845, a courthouse for the county was built. The Midwest was Lincoln land, and Abraham Lincoln passed through Sullivan many times from 1849 to 1852 as he practiced law in the Moultrie County Circuit Court. Sullivan is the typical farming community. Small town feeling everywhere you turn, local bars serving patrons that sit and gossip about the weekly town news, a few restaurants, and historical sites. The closest cities are Decatur and Mattoon, Illinois. Many people move away from their small towns after high school and go to college.
We did.
Many get married, have kids. You know, the whole adulting part of life. Many people did move on, but Sherry stayed in Sullivan. She had her first child as a teenager and had her second child later in her 30s. The youngest child was only in second grade by the time his mom was brutally murdered. Sherry was one of those beautiful souls that you meet only once in a lifetime. Her infectious smile and ability to make you laugh at your lowest points were always part of her signature warm personality. But time does pass, and we tend to live our lives in our own corner of the world, keeping in touch with our friends and family less and less as we tend about our own busy lives. We have social media to help us stay in contact with those people, as well as get updates on their daily lives also. Nobody ever wants to hear bad news that your friend was hurt or in pain, but to get the news that a friend has been brutally murdered is heartbreaking. As I stated earlier, Sherry had two children and one grandchild. She loved being a mother and grandmother. Her family lived nearby, and she had many friends that loved her very much. Her memories are still very much alive today. Sherry went to community college, She received a nursing degree and worked at one of the local nursing homes in the area. Sherry was married before and estranged from her husband. There's not a lot of detail on the first marriage at all, but she was dating and she had a few close male friends, so she was single parenting, doing it all on her own. Sherry and Michael Yost dated and had a very brief relationship. At the time of her murder, they were not seeing each other. However, in Michael's mind, Sherry was still the love of his life. It seemed that a few years before Michael murdered Sherry, there was domestic violence involved, as well as court documents filed in relation to Yost's breaking into Randall's apartment. He was stalking her and finding ways to interact with her, even after they stopped seeing each other. The bars in town were stomping grounds for both Sherry and Michael. The town is small, and it's easy to run into one another all the time. That's totally understandable. That's how, when the town we grew up in, I was hated it. Everybody knew each your business. Your business.
Well, we got out of there before anybody cared.
I know, but still. Michael was always on the lookout for Sherry, and it wasn't hard finding her in a town so small. Here's what Michael's behaviors were. Common patterns for those that are more than obsessed with someone. They can't let go of the fact that the relationship is over. Domestic violence doesn't look the same in every relationship, because every relationship is different. But one thing most abusive relationships have in common is that the abusive partner does many different kinds of things to have more power and control over their partner. From the beginning, there were apparent issues that were a part of their relationship, and as Sherry tried to break away from Michael, he made it quite clear that he was not going to live without her. In the four-day bench trial, Michael Yost read his allocution. He was adamant that he and Sherry were back together and doing great. There was zero evidence of that claim at all. In fact, there were numerous testimonies to discount Yost's claim. Obviously a part of his delusional and obsessive pattern with her. We will get to the part of relevance as the case unfolds from Michael's testimony. But you will come to see that this man was even trying to assert his control over Sherry a year after he brutally murdered her.
He was trying to get everybody to see things his way.
Exactly.
That's terrible.
As the way he knows to be true, I guess. Yost's behavior the night before the murder, the day of, and over a year later at trial, lays a picture of a man that wanted control and garnered sympathy from those around him. His passive-aggressive behaviors are earmarked of a deranged hypocrite. Here's a man that says he loves a woman so intensely that he could never hurt the woman he loves. And yet his pattern of abuse and behavior the night of March 3rd, 2015, shows the real love that he had for Sherry. A selfish and abusive love that led to the heinous murder of a beautiful soul. So let's set the stage with the murder itself. The night of March 3rd, 2015. The Landing is a popular bar in Sullivan, and Yost was out with friends, hanging out and moderately drinking, as witnesses observed. Sherry and her friends showed up at the bar to be together and just to have fun. Yost approached Sherry and her friends and was seen buying her numerous amounts of drinks, trying to insert himself into their girls' night out. Apparently, witnesses had observed Michael interacting with Sherry and also testified that he was later kicked out of a bar around 10:30 p.m. for causing a ruckus. Nobody mentioned if it was because of he was fighting with Sherry, but there were statements at trial indicating that Yost told people he ought to kill that effing bitch. Those very words were echoed a week prior to Sherry's death as friends of Sherry's had phone conversations with Yost as he stated he couldn't live without her and he was going to kill her. His rage was quite evident and clear the night of the incident as well as a week prior to her death. He was obviously harboring hate towards Sherry, and that would lead one to assume that Michael was not getting his way and he obviously wanted her back. An ex-girlfriend of Yost testified at trial that she had spoken to Michael on the phone and he told her that he had fantasies of killing her and then killing himself. It's not clear how Michael got into Sherry's apartment that night, but there was mention of a broken window in the bedroom of Sherry's young son. Later, police investigators would mention that Yost's phone was found in the bedroom just below that window. He did throw his phone and it broke the glass. Oh, did he throw his phone and it broke the glass, or did he show up at Sherry's house after he had been kicked out of the bar? It's likely he was mad that things didn't go as planned when he was at the Landing, buying Sherry those drinks. His idea was probably to get her drunk and try to talk her into getting back together. It's also possible that his very thoughts were to get her drunk, show up at her apartment, and take advantage of her while she was intoxicated. The toxicology report done on Sherry was a 0.246%, well above the 0.08 limit. The crime scene itself was bloody and horrific. On Wednesday, March 4th, 2015, the next day, Sherry was found by a neighboring tenant around 11 a.m. The authorities were called to the scene, and what they found was like out of a horror movie, except this was real life, very real and unimaginable. As the authorities entered the residence, they came upon Sherry's lifeless body draped with a small cover. She was covered like she was lying there sleeping.
So obviously he felt a little guilty, so he covered it.
So next to her on the bedroom floor was Michael Yost, the ex-boyfriend. Both were bloody and full of stab wounds. Sherry was pronounced dead on the scene while Michael was transported to St. Mary's Hospital in Decatur, Illinois. There he would be treated for his wounds and undergo surgery. Michael was unresponsive and had 9 stab wounds to his lower body and abdomen. Ugh. He also had a punctured lung. At the EMT's initial report, had thought he had a collapsed lung. Yost recovered in the hospital and on his 6th day was arrested and brought up on 4 counts of first-degree murder charges.
How did he get 4?
He was arrested and transported to the Moultrie County Jail. So let's go back to the murder scene for a bit. This is a surmisal of all the events that night and more information about the scene as it was represented at Michael's trial.
What does surmisal mean?
Surmisal is an opinion or someone's view.
Okay.
And I'm hoping that's the correct way to pronounce it.
The guesstimate, but okay.
Guesstimate works. It's not clear how Michael ended up at Sherry's apartment that night of March 3rd. But it's known that he had been with her earlier at the Landing Bar. He was buying her drinks, all the while paying close attention to his own alcohol consumption. So it sounds like he was trying to get her drunk, and he was keeping himself mentally fit. The judge made mention of Yost's moderate drinking that night. He stated that this was clear evidence to him that Yost's drinking pattern was curtailed. This persuaded the judge to assume that this was just another action towards his pre-planned murder.
He was premeditating it.
He knew that he was going to keep sober.
He was doing it on purpose. Yeah.
Right. Yost either coaxed her into going back to the apartment to sleep off the alcohol or just showed up. Either way, he knew she was home. Think about that for a minute.
I think she went home by herself.
I do too. I think he followed her.
And the door. I mean, the window and the cell phone.
He was lurking in the night, waiting for her to return home so he could take his final revenge. No doubt about it, he knew he was going to kill her. All his efforts to try to get her back and all the conversations he had with other people showed that Michael was obsessed with Sherry. Here's some more sick facts about Yost's depraved behavior. One day prior to Sherry's death, Michael spent more than 6 hours watching pornographic videos about pain, forced sex, and murder. Testimony by a special agent with the Illinois State Police Investigations said in his testimony that there were internet search histories recovered from Yost's phone. They dated back to March 3rd, the day before Sherry was found. Also, an ex-girlfriend remembered that Michael had told her that he had fantasized about Sherry suffering in pain. The internet searches on Michael's phone were from about 9:30 a.m. and ended around 3:50 p.m. So there's no doubt Yost was pumping himself up to go and find Sherry to commit these heinous acts. This sick bastard was fantasizing about her murder and how he was going to do it. Stop for a minute. Do you understand that 48 hours before Sherry was brutally murdered, the sick man was obsessing about how he was going to kill her and sexually gratifying himself to those very thoughts?
So he was watching porn for 6 hours, and it was the graphic, violent porn?
Sex, torture porn.
Sounds like a nice guy.
That's sick and depraved. And here's the even scarier thought. Poor Sherry had zero clue that this was about to happen. This man's dark and depraved obsession was about to take more of a malevolent turn. On a side note, it's believed that Sherry was off work for a few months because she had fallen and broken her ankle and required surgery. You know a little bit about that, don't you?
Yep.
So her being out on that weeknight was more because she was still nursing an injury and not going to work. Her little boy was not at home at the time, so that's a good thing. They don't really know where he was, but he was not home. Thank the Lord.
Probably with his dad.
Yeah, hopefully. Well, no, she was estranged from her husband, so.
Grandma?
Maybe. Or maybe the neighbor that found her. I'm not for sure. But we don't know. We can only assume because there's no statements.
Okay.
So going back to the scene of the crime, let's continue with what Michael says were his memories or lack thereof. It seems that once back in the apartment, Michael says he remembers Sherry frying cheese at the kitchen stove. And then sometimes later, he woke up on the floor between Sherry's bed and a dresser to find a knife stuck in his abdomen.
Mm-hmm. So he's pretending like he didn't do it?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. It seems, or he's trying to claim some kind of amnesia.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The crime scene techs, as well as the neighbor that found them, said Michael was actually discovered naked and lying on his side, his left arm draped across Sherry's torso. Michael blamed his lack of memory about the crime was due to extremely low blood sugar caused by poor management of his diabetes.
It didn't have anything to do with bleeding out on the floor?
He said he remembered her frying cheese, and the next thing he knew, he was laying on the floor. Mm-hmm. And then he blamed it on his blood sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Well, really bad management if he's drinking, because you're not supposed to drink if you're diabetic.
Nope.
That fact was argued at trial by Michael's attorney, Brad Rao. Rao had fought for an appeal at Yost's sentencing, claiming that Yost's actions did not constitute wanton cruelty. The judge disagreed, alluding to Sherry's 21 stab wounds and slow death. The judge went on to say that the damage caused by Michael's premeditated crime cannot be measured.
It's terrible.
One must pause for a minute and think about the agony and pain that Sherry endured as she laid on the floor bleeding out from the eviscerated wound in her abdomen. That was the one stab that killed her. Remember, she had had 20 other ones. That
was the fatal one.
The fatal one was the stab wound to the stomach.
Ugh, that would be so terrible to go.
She bled out. I mean,
awful.
And you know, since her blood alcohol was so high, she probably did fairly quickly, but still, that's not quick enough. It shouldn't have happened at all. What was the conversation like between a man who professed his love for a woman and yet sliced her up like a piece of meat and laid next to her while she was dying? The obvious cry for help and screams of pain did not stop him from methodically stabbing her flesh, all the while laying framework in his sick and obsessed mind as to how he would die with her or make it look as if someone came in and murdered Sherry and then attempted to murder Michael.
So he was hoping not to get caught.
Right. Almost seems like he was hoping to die himself. This was going to be a murder-suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Kelly Biggs, a forensic scientist for the Illinois State Police, testified for the prosecution, stating that there were no obvious signs of sexual assault on Sherry's body, although that was still a topic up for debate because the evidence left at the scene. There were four knives found near the body of Sherry and Michael Yost. Biggs stated that the shortest knife blade was used repeatedly to stab and cut Michael himself.
Of course he picked
the shortest one. Is that an allegory for his manhood?
I would say so.
An Urbana-based forensic pathologist performed an autopsy on Sherry. They gave testimony of Michael's wounds based on a review of Yost's medical records and photographs of his injuries from the St. Mary's Hospital. The pathologist said that Michael suffered 9 relatively shallow stab wounds, 2 to his chest and 7 to his abdomen, and that did not, in his opinion, reflect a desire to die. So I guess he didn't want to murder-suicide.
Oh, I guess that's also like where it is on the body. You know what I mean? That has to be pretty telling.
Well, it was in his abdomen.
Yeah, but like what part? Is it like over here where there's not...
Well, that would be your side.
But it's still your abdomen, though, this part.
Mm-hmm. His suicide defense was bogus at best. Yet another self-depreciating desire to garner sympathy from people and to hopefully convince the judge that he was not guilty. Yost staged the whole scene and was willing to cut himself up in a poor attempt to kill himself. And those were in quotes.
So it has to be pretty obvious where he had stabbed himself.
You would think so. But if he would use the shortest knife, too.
And the location.
To
the authorities, it would be pretty clear that it was faked.
Right. At trial, during more of Yost's statements, he was trying to throw suspicion towards others as he read from his handwritten statement. Yost attacked state's attorney Jeremy Ritchie for neither investigating Sherry's estranged husband nor men with whom she had been exchanging pornographic messages and pictures online in the months leading up to her death.
Sexting?
Sexting, but that part is in quotes, so he might just be making that up.
Okay, I got you.
And this is a quote. Mrs. Randall was living a secret life of which her friends, family, and myself knew nothing of.
Or she was leading a single life and can do as she pleases.
Exactly. She's an adult. Undoubtedly, Michael had snooped around Sherry's apartment and looked into her computer as well as phone to retrieve texts and emails that he says were of pornographic nature. Sherry's phone was found in the bathroom sink, floating in bloody water.
Says the man who watched 6 hours of porn before he attacked
That's
her.
That's what I'm thinking.
Right?
That, he put it in bloody water, so he was trying to ruin the phone so they couldn't get anything. He was enraged, and finding out that she was continuing on with her life was more fuel to his already crazed mind. Another forensic biologist, DNA analyst with the Illinois State Police, testified that the blood samples taken from the knife with the smaller blade came from one person, and that DNA profile matched that of Michael Yost. So he intentionally and cowardly used the smaller bladed knife as to not puncture too deeply to cause major organ damage. This also shows consistent premeditation of crime.
What a jerk.
Sherry's injuries? 15 stab wounds that went very deep and 5 superficial lacerations. The deep wounds did not hit any major arteries or organs, so Sherry laid there for an hour or more bleeding out before dying.
Oh my God, so the alcohol didn't make her bleed faster. That's a horrible death.
Well, depending on if it didn't hit any major arteries, she wouldn't have bled quickly anyway.
Yeah, but I hope in instances like that it does go quick. I hope it goes quickly. Suffer, you know? Obviously,
it's so horrifying. Suffered. And then the guy right next to her that did it and she couldn't move or get help.
My God.
There's a beautiful woman laying on her bedroom floor, dying, slowly dying in agony. Her thoughts of her children and grandchild passing through her pain-clouded mind. The memories of family and friends and the thought of never, ever seeing them again. This man in her apartment, who she used to be intimate with, busying around the place, looking for more knives, going through personal effects, attempting to cut himself as an act of heroism to show her he would bleed for her.
He'd bleed, but he's not going to die because he's a chicken. Ugh.
Her last hours alive. Nobody there to save her. That apartment was filled with rage from an obsessed and crazed man, and the air was thick with fear and utter sadness from a dying 43-year-old mother of two, Sherry Randall. The pretrial and trial dates and verdict. Yost arrested on Tuesday, March 10th, 2015. The pretrial was April 1st, 2015. Yost pled not guilty and requested a trial jury. However, a bench trial was set in place, and that trial was September 12th through the 16th of 2016.
It went pretty quick, actually. Mm-hmm.
The state put on over 24 witnesses and expert testimonies. Key evidence at the trial was DNA, witness testimony in relation to Yost's physical threats, expert witness testimony in relation to injuries sustained by victim, and the defendant's internet history and violent criminal past. Yost was previously convicted in 1992 in Platt County of aggravated criminal sexual assault of a minor younger than 13 years of age.
Here's a note that I have for everybody that's single.
What a shit.
If you're dating, you
check it out.
Google people. Look it up. It's pretty easy to find out if
not only
it's
Google
easy to find records,
get a background check, records. Pay that
$30. Don't even pay for that. All you have to do is just go. We can put the links on our thing. I do it all the time, just because I'm nosy.
Yeah, but there's some things you have to pay for. Like
yeah, but you can see if they've been arrested. That's public knowledge. Go ahead.
Just look them up. The verdict was guilty on 4 counts of first degree murder. The sentencing was 75 years on the 4th count, the most serious charge, that of exceptionally brutal and heinous behavior with intent to kill. Yost must serve 100% of the 75 years because he was found guilty of first-degree murder and Illinois law enforces full sentencing. At sentencing, Michael Yost gave his statements. Michael told the judge and the people in the courtroom that he loved Sherry. He stood there professing his love and would trade places with her in a heartbeat if he could. At his sentencing trial, Michael also brought up that his attorney refused to present evidence at his former trial that he and Sherry were back together and getting along at the time of her death.
Just because he ran into her in a bar and bought her drinks, to get her drunk, does not make one a couple
right.
again.
He still was vehemently appearing to look like a victim and pushing for a retrial, which is apparently being reviewed as the first part of this year. While Michael was being transported to the Decatur jail by ambulance, a Moultrie County Sheriff's deputy found a note that was in the waistband of Michael's boxer shorts. The letter was addressed to Michael's parents and signed by Michael. The deputy testified that the author of the note could not live without Sherry because she was and is my life, and asked to be buried as close to her as possible in Oak Grove Cemetery in Bethany, Illinois. He also acknowledged in the letter that people think he killed her, but, quote, only she and I know the truth, end of quote. So that, I'm assuming, is an apparent suicide attempt letter, like a suicide letter. As Michael was leaving the courtroom to start his jail sentence, he had one last comment to add to his already perverted and disgusting statements in a form of a gesture. He flipped off the family and friends of Sherry and looked at his family in disgust.
Now, why would he do that?
He needs to be burned at the stake.
See, I truly believe that people sometimes are so deluded and demented that in his head, he probably thinks they were together. She just, it was all her.
Right.
She had, you know, she was having a rough time of it, but he was there for her and they were really together.
The story is tragic, disgusting, and horrific. No words can really describe the loss of Sherry Randall. Nothing can be done now to bring her back. This is a cautionary tale, a tale of obsessed, violent behavior. Domestic violence is a major crime being tried in many courts across our country. Domestic abuse calls are some of the number one complaints that officers are called to daily. The crime is usually filled with rage and usually ends up with violent injuries, some resulting in death. As we hear the story of Sherry, it's important to understand that she suffered greatly. There are signs of Michael's violence before the murder. Let's not forget that oftentimes victims show visible signs as well as carry themselves with attributes that are indicative of abuse. If you know someone or suspect someone is in an abusive relationship, please call and get them help. If you are a victim, reach out. There's no reason to suffer in silence. Writing this was Chris Maltby's tribute to Sherry. So if that was her plea to please call someone, and she gives us the number to the National Domestic Violence Hotline, and that's 1-800-799-7233. And seriously, do call.
Looking back on that story, thank you, Chris, first of all.
Thank you so much, Chris.
And
what
secondly,
a heartbreaking story.
It just seems like there were so many people in there that could have said something or done something. If I were with you and we were at a bar and I was mm-hmm. knowing, well, we always had that truce with each other, well, mm-hmm. us and our little group of friends, that if one person got inebriated, you did not ever
leave them
because of, well, for many
things
reasons.
That can happen.
Yes. So he's screaming that he was going to kill her or whatever in front of those people. Like, you would think somebody would be, you know,
on that and say,
I guess people just kind of tend.
Or, oh, that's Michael. He's always.
That's the personal business. You know, that
right.
used to be the big thing.
Well, maybe he was always threatening to kill people.
Well, still.
But
though,
it's different it's, when it's, people are joking and it's like, yeah, I'm going to kill you. Or if I have to tell you, I'll have to kill you.
When you're doing it in anger, you know what I mean? That's
and you're screaming.
Red flag. And that you know the background, that they've had a rough time.
And he's been violent before. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was, I wonder if everybody had in the town knew about his conviction.
Where it was.
Like, for the rape of the younger than 13 child.
Because that would be, you would think that would make the news.
Well, you would think that he'd be a registered sex offender.
Yes, he would. I mean, that was.
Because I mean, I always, ago. That's another thing that I do. Well, like you said, well, you want to say what you were going to say? About the if you're dating
oh
nowadays.
If you're dating somebody, if you're single these days, ladies
and men
too,
anyone.
You need to Google people. You Google them. I'm really good at finding out information I mm-hmm. shouldn't find out. I pride myself on that because I'm nosy. But you can Google people. You can look up, you know, the state highway. You can look up their driving records. You can look up if they've been arrested. You can go to any jail site and it will have like mugshots. St. Louis, I think it's stlmugshot.com, something like that. And it's like everybody that's been arrested lately. Mm-hmm.
They do that. And they also have the sex predator website yeah. where anybody that is arrested or registered sex offender in your area will pop up. So those names will pop up there. Even if you have to pay the $30 or whatever amount to do an incomplete background check to see if they've filed for bankruptcy, do it. You just can't.
Matters, but
it doesn't matter. But
if they're a con man and they're asking for money.
Right. Mm. I mean, you just can't be too safe. And it's scary nowadays.
Scary.
Well, and it's only, and you know, this was happening back
well, he did it
in
before,
the days.
Obviously.
Right.
That's why she broke up with him.
But we have the technology now. Use it now. Just know. Be safe out there.
Just to, with people like him, you can, they put on such a front. That they're such a nice guy. I'm sure it takes a while to, much like a child molester, they groom you to, it's all you, it's not me, I love you, you know, that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. And so I'm sure it took a while for her to see it, and then she did, and then, you know, it's
yeah.
terrible.
But just be careful of the warning signs, people. That's very sad. We don't want you to end up like Sherry. And I feel so sorry for Sherry's parents, especially if they're re-examining the trial now. Thank
right.
you, Chris. That
Thank
was-
you, Chris.
Such a heartbreaking story. Thank you for sharing it. It must have been hard writing it, really, to bring back those painful memories again. So just send our love to the family, and I hope they are healing as well as they can. Alrighty, so if you guys want to contact us, we are mostly on Twitter, at Our True Crime Pod is the username. If you would like to leave us a 5-star review.
Only 5 stars.
Just be nice, because I will let you know that if you ding us for grammar or something similar, we will make fun of you.
I got no reason that I should have has the problem with that.
Right. There. If you have something like that, please just email us. There's no reason to leave a nasty review. And like I said, we will make fun of you, and it will be
That's
well
the joys
known.
Of us having a podcast. You might get to leave a bad review, but we get to say what we want.
And we can put it out there for the
Which is so
five
petty.
People that listen.
Guess what?
It is so petty, and we are petty girls.
Petty AF.
Pretty petty people. That's us, the three Ps. But anyway, do what you want, and it's always at your own consequences. let's see. And you know what? Not only just leave us a nice review, leave other podcasts that you like to listen to a nice review, especially your indie podcasts like us. They like to hear it, because otherwise we're just thinking we're speaking into a void. And we use our own money and our own scripts that we write
except
from
that one.
Researched, except for this one, that we research. We do not copy from Dateline or all those other shows like some other podcasts that shall remain nameless. But yeah, anyway, that's all I've got to say. Contact us. Send us an email of your complaints to ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. Like I said, thank you, Chris, for writing the script for the show and making us aware of Sherry Randall's story. And if any of you would like to submit a script, send it to ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. And if we like it and decide to air it, we will send you a t-shirt. Of our true crime podcast.
We will send you a t-shirt, an old t-shirt that we found at the Goodwill,
mm-hmm.
but it'll be yours.
So anyway.
All right. Remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya.
Thank you.
It was a summer of 69. Sorry, couldn't help it.
This is the sad, tragic case of Sherry Standifer Randall.
Say that again, because you smushed case together. I smushed case together.
This is the sad...
You scared the dog.
I know.
Sorry, go ahead.
Okay. Sullivan is the farming community town. Mattoon. We're going with Mattoon.
How do you spell it?
M-A-T-T-O-O-N. Mattoon.
Yeah, I'd say Mattoon.
Mattoon. As I stated earlier, Sherry had two children, one grandchild. As I stated 50 times before this. As I stated earlier, the crime scene itself was a bloody...
was a bloody mess, it was!
It was a bloody mess. Very real and
phenomena.
Except this...
phenomena. There you go.